the MadTech Podcast Special, focusing on the most important topics in AdTech and MarTech.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the MadTech Podcast. I'm John Still, ExchangeWise Head of Content, and today we're going to be doing a bit of future gazing, a bit of taking the temperature of the ad industry and looking at the biggest opportunities in tech over the coming months and even years. To shed some light on the direction the industry is heading, I'm joined today by the founder of Madison & Wall, Brian Weezer. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you very much for joining us today. And chatting with Brian today is going to be ExchangeWise CSO, Kieran O'Kane. Kieran, pleasure as always.
Hello, John. Hello, Brian. Great to see you both today.
Good to see you. Thank you for joining us. As I've said, this is going to be a fairly free-flowing conversation between you two. I know you're both looking forward to it. So I'm going to chuck in a fairly wide-ranging question to start. Brian, what shifts have you seen recently in the ad industry? And what do you think is really driving change at the moment?
That's a good question. I mean, I'd say that there's a few things that are really captivating marketers right now. Retail media, probably most pronounced among them. And I think that inside of individual media, there's always lots of change, like connected TV inside of television. Measurement's a big issue for a lot of marketers. But I think that the bigger issue is just right now, everyone feels super uncertain. And I think that's been, I don't want to say incorrect. There's always uncertainty. But I feel like the most important dynamic going on for marketers and for corporations of all sizes and all types is just they don't have any sense of confidence about how healthy the economy is, at least in the United States and at a global level. I recognize that in many countries around the world, it's still problematic conditions going on, and that makes it tricky. But, those who listen to my old podcast when I was at Group M will remember that at the beginning of last year, we were kind of mocking the idea that the world was going into a downturn when everyone was freaking out. And I was right about the world not going into a downturn. The conditions have only been good. There has been no global recession nor any US recession, but everyone keeps waiting for it.
Yeah, uncertain times is certainly right. I think we're seeing a very prevailing air of caution around the industry at the moment. Kieran, what do you think?
It's probably the new real, isn't it? Interesting that the economy is still top of mind for marketers, and rightly so. I think the UK has been in a recession for many years. I'd say it's been a recession since Brexit at this stage. So,
stop advertising from growing at a ludicrous pace.
Absolutely. And it's just, look at all the new companies who kind of sort of muscled their way into advertising. I had lunch today with someone who just basically said, agencies are hilarious in the same cycles that we're seeing now. The agencies are cycles we saw 15 years ago, right? Everybody's predicting their demise, and then they figure out how to get through that sort of crisis, and then they're still doing pretty well, right? So, advertising is still growing, right? Despite the economic fears, and there's always going to be economic, people are always worried about the economy, I think people are waiting for, the bottom to fall out of the market and have all their worst nightmares realized. But the reality is people are still spending money, right? They're finding ways to spend money on travel. They're spending money on other sort of non-necessities. They're pulling back on some spend. We can go into this in a minute, but the streaming stuff is really interesting from an economic point of view. Is all this money has been sort of spent in building these platforms, and now all the streamers realize that they've been charging too little for the service, and they're trying to hike the prices. And suddenly we're in this situation where it might be actually easier to get a cable bundle in the US than it would be to pay for all these individual streamers.
This is the thing, actually, and maybe the common thread here is there's a lot of bad analysis, poor analysis, and very limited analysis in certain things. And assertions get made that get repeated, despite being often incorrect, right? Like the idea that, consumers can't possibly pay for these streaming services. And it then becomes an anecdote that gets repeated, right? And so then there's a presumption that it'll consumers won't pay or something. And I read this certainly in the UK or press or in the American press. And it's like, well, wait a second. First of all, the amount that consumers are spending on streaming services represents still a very small share of what they're spending on video collectively. Mm. In the US, that's around 30%, probably not dissimilar in the UK. And further, if you look at it through the lens, if there is, and I know the term cost of living crisis is used a lot in the UK, it's used increasingly in the US. There's always a cost of living crisis going on for many, many people in the population. But the reality is that if you agree with the premise that that's what's happening, home-based video entertainment is one of the greatest values you'll ever find. And so it doesn't follow that advertising is part of that, because part of that home-based entertainment enjoyment may be not having any ads to watch. So you can still have a lot of growth in that space. But again, the assertions that people won't do this, won't do that, usually aren't rooted much in fact or data or real analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I always love your sort of perspective of the world. Everything's relative, right? You know, like the advertising pie is growing, but it's not like pulling money away. It's just flowing elsewhere. And it's just like the same could probably be applied to people's spending habits, right? So, you know, most Gen Zers are not drinking as much as they used to, right? Alcohol consumption is going down. So they've got money to spend elsewhere. So they'll probably allocate that to entertainment, right?
Exactly. And that's
life experiences
example.
Or whatever. Like, so it's just, the more things change, the more to stay the same. Like, but there are sort of interesting sort of like areas and Brian is newsletter, which is an excellent read, by the way, a fantastic overview of the industry, and insights are always really, really good. But Brian, one of the things you talked about was the retail media sort of push, and I remember reading. I was reading the Instacart overview from you and your recent email. It's just interesting to see how all these new companies are kind of muscling their way into a sort of relatively new channel, and I use that as sort of a fairly loose term, because it's fair to say channel, because you could argue that retail media has been around for a long time. It's just like it's now like, you know, physically moving physical shelf space to virtual shelf space effectively. But it'd be good to sort of get your insight into how that's shaping up, because one of the things we've been doing is we've done a lot of content. John's been spearheading that around the retail media space, and we've done that. We do these sketches every other week, and we did one on Uber, and we showed how Uber's business is completely, you know, the ad business is kind of propping up the free cash flow of the business effectively. Like the rest of the business kind of almost runs break even, and suddenly you have this like $1 billion run rate advertising business that's actually going to give profitability to this, and likewise Instacart. So it's just interesting. I think it'd be interesting to get your point of view on that. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, clearly these revenue streams, when they're driving high contribution margins, where again, for every dollar of incremental revenue, you're, you know, really producing, it could be something like 70-80% of that dollar goes into your bottom line, a really high contribution margin. Those are really, really good businesses for companies to have when they can. But a couple of things that are important to consider. If you can't create a hyper-competitive environment, it's really hard to make this a massive business. Meaning, you know, one reason why Amazon has built such a big business, whatever the right size of the pure, pure retail media, like, again, strip out the fact that there's like NFL football, there's some audio, there's a lot of other things in there. But the vast majority of the Amazon number is what I think we would all call retail media. It's driven by the fact that they've created this marketplace. And the marketplace is really where the bulk of Amazon's focus is. And this is a critical point that, according to sources that I've tried to track and other data points I've looked at, manufacturers from China probably driving half or more in some countries of the total activity there. So you have all these non-branded entities that are capitalizing on zero cost shipping or next to zero cost shipping, right? It's cheaper to send something from Shenzhen to Los Angeles or Shenzhen to Birmingham than it is to send something from London to Birmingham, probably. And so you have all these fragmented non-branded entities that are trying to make sure they're getting to the top of your search. And that's really what's driving a huge share of the advertising revenue, as far as I can piece together from public information. So you go to, why is Walmart so much smaller right now? I mean, growing, doing well, right? They're playing the same playbook out. And I'm sure you'll see the same from a Tesco and a Carrefour and every other major retailer. But if they can't build out a big enough marketplace and attract enough competitive demand, it's going to be a niche business. So take Uber. Great that they can make it competitive between one local restaurant and another local restaurant. The same with any of these other food delivery businesses. They'll create real businesses. It's just not going to be anything like the same kind of scale unless you can find a way to create, like, restaurants will never have more than a small number of other direct competitors, right? Like, you want a burrito within a 5-minute radius. Well, there's only so many places that'll make that burrito. But if you want to get an iPhone case, if it could be manufactured by any of 100 different entities, all of them in one part of China where they have no domestic market growth to play with, they've got international markets to focus on. Now you're going to create a hyper-competitive environment. And that's advertising. Remember, this is the thing people forget. Very few companies go into the world saying, I can't wait to spend me some money on advertising. Advertising is something that nobody wants. It is a least bad alternative choice, right? Like, you spend money on advertising because it's better than the alternative of not spending money on advertising. So how do you create those conditions if you're the manufacturer, if you're the media owner? And anyone who can do that well will create a big business.
In my view, I think that's where programmatic makes retail media interesting. Because if you have all of these sort of, let's call them second-tier players compared to an Amazon or even a Walmart, even when you get outside the US, it just becomes like subscale. You know, a Tesco's or a Sainsbury's, a Carrefour, they're big, but they're not massive. So I think this is where a programmatic play is interesting, because then you can aggregate all of this supply, particularly around like product listing advertising, right? And if there's a way for you to kind of aggregate that and scale it, it then becomes interesting to CPGs and direct-to-consumer brands in a way. I mean, it's chalk and cheese, definitely, from Amazon. To your point around, you know, the marketplace could scale. But, like, if you want retail media to realize its opportunity, I think you're right. It can't exist in all of these sort of fragmented, subscale commerce media, retail media entities.
Yeah, I think that's right. If Carrefour or Tesco by itself is big in its home market for their home markets for physical retail based activity, but this is where it's different. It's not the same as retail media that existed even 10 years ago, where there was forced sales of attempting to capture trade budgets. This is well beyond that, right? You can estimate that roughly on Amazon, even maybe a third at most of the ad revenue is trade budgets. The bulk of it is not. And so how do you create that demand if you're again, just not to pick on Tesco, but you're Tesco, you are still a very, very large global retailer, but Amazon is substantially bigger. And so if you are that small business in Shenzhen, I mean, you've got 5 employees, right? You're outsourcing your manufacturing to someone else. You know, you can only prioritize so many places. Now, can Tesco or Carrefour or Target or Walmart, can they make sure that they can build a marketplace that's sufficiently compelling to attract all of those sources all the manufacturers and make it easy for them to plug into that inventory? You know, and I haven't dug into this enough, but I know when it comes to one of the reasons why Facebook and Google or Meta and Alphabet became so big is because for every advertiser, they became the first place to go to, regardless of size. And if you are, you know, in the US, the numbers would be something like the typical business has about $1 million of revenue or turnover. They have about 2.5 employees. They spend about $10,000 per year on advertising. So it's no one's full-time job, first of all, to focus on advertising. And secondly, the absolute budgets are small. If you only have that much to spend, and again, I think you could ratchet down that number for the UK or for Europe, or whatever, it'd be roughly similar in proportion. There's a reason why you're not going to distribute that spending to more than a couple of media platforms. It's just logistically impossible. Forget about the programmatic thing. Yeah, you're going to automate as much as you can, but you can't manage it. You can't optimize it. It's not worth the while, right? When you're dealing at that small a scale. Now, the bigger you get as a manufacturer, the bigger you get as a marketer, the more sense it makes to never be dependent on any one platform, right? And this is why you see this with larger brands actively looking to diversify their spending away from Meta, away from Amazon, if they can, and encourage the Snaps of the world and the Pinterests of the world. And yeah, even the X's, I mean, at least they were when it was Twitter. And that makes sense at that scale. So go back to if you're a Nestle, if you're a Mondelez, if you're a L'Oreal, right? You absolutely are going to try to have a presence on Tesco's platform for retail media, a presence on Walmart, a presence, every major retailer that sets up a retail media network, you're going to make sure you're there. But the competitive intensity is going to be radically different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what limits the scale for a lot of these platforms.
Kieran, did you have anything to add on that one?
Well, it just feels like Brian's saying that, potentially saying that retail media is a little bit hype. There's a lot of hype around it.
Say that. I mean, it's growing.
I'm not accusing you of calling it a hype, but like, it's a fair point to make when you compare it to Amazon. I suppose that's good that when people talk about it, they never really talk about Amazon. So it's almost like they talk about it as if it's like display advertising, right? It's for like the top 1,000 CPGs and maybe a scattering of sort of like, you know.
I think it's way more distributed than that.
Yeah.
To be clear, when it comes to large brands, and this is why, again, I'd say it's not hype, but although the expectations for some participants might be poorly formed, but it's safe to say, you know, when I was at GroupM, we published some of this analysis that I did where I looked at billings data for the US only, but I think it's illustrative for the rest of the world. So I looked at raw billings data for, scores of advertisers who basically account for the vast majority of US-based activity. And I looked at the percentage of revenue that there were eight large packaged goods clients that on a like-for-like basis were around 2019, 2020, 2021 during this period. And the percentage of budget allocations going to Amazon, Walmart, Target, Instacart, and yeah, even then, it was going something like 3% of budget the first year, 2019, 6% in 2020, 12% 2021. Not hard to imagine it would have been substantially bigger in 2022. For that subset of eight manufacturers, that's a huge change, right? And you think about that kind of a shift. So to be clear, that and anecdotally, when you talk to these sorts of manufacturers, it is a primary area of focus in terms of where they're allocating their money. I think it gets interesting and maybe harder to imagine when you think about a non-endemic manufacturer. Like, what do they do? Like, if you make, I don't know, if you're Nike, are you going to advertise on Uber? I mean, you could. It doesn't. But Uber is trying to get to that place.
I think the non-endemic advertising is a busted flush. I think where things will happen, like so the most of the M&A has happened in retail media is around sort of product listing advertising, right? Hooklogix went to Criteo, Citrus Ads got bought by Publicis. Is it Intent IQ got bought by Microsoft? I actually think that's where the sweet spot is for this, because there's a couple of things that sort of prevent big sort of streaming video ads or non-endemic ads being plastered across the Tesco, Carrefour, Sainsbury's, Uber. It's UX, right? User experience. Because at the end of the day, a Tesco is there to sell product, not to sort of like monetize via advertising, monetize content or audiences via advertising. That's not their raison d'etre. And I think that that's where I think there will be sort of rubber hits the road around this. And I think I know Brian's right about Amazon, right? Amazon's just so scale. It has economy scale where you do have like a subset of like random manufacturers competing in a category that's one of millions of categories on Amazon, which gives it unbelievable scale. And really retail media and Uber, like if you look at Uber, right, they have tapped into sort of a shifting trade budgets. Like, so there is now teams within the brands who said, well, consumer habits have changed, right? People are eating out more or ordering more on these apps versus than walking down the street and buying the groceries to go home and cooked it. So we now have to shift some of our spend that was being allocated shelf space for Sainsbury's into Uber, right? So if you buy a burrito or whatever in Uber Eats, you only have a can of Coke or a bottle of Asahi or something, right? Those trade budget teams now are actively doing. So there's money shifting around from that pocket of cash.
Keep in mind though, that I think the non-endemic opportunity is very real. And this is where, again, Amazon in particular, focusing on its investment on Prime Video and the ad-supported former IMDb, now Freevee. And you'll have a better view on this than I do. I'm fascinated by what Rakuten's tried to do in Europe, right? They're launching fast channels across the region.
I don't think it's working.
But at least it's the right idea. If you wanted to, now Rakuten also doesn't have much of an e-commerce presence in Europe, but clearly they have ambitions. And so imagine it might make way more sense if a Tesco had a fast series or a fast series of channels, right? Now it's a big investment, but that's where you could attract the non-endemic manufacturer.
So probably segues nice into the TV conversation, but my view on a lot of this stuff is that, you know, that you have to kind of almost separate the US from the rest of the world, right? The US has had a culture of you know, television bundles, which were quite costly for a lot of people, which included various channels like CNN and ESPN and all the rest of it, right? There's never been really like a widespread culture of, you know, of free TV, ad support TV, which is something we've grown up with. I've grown up with that in Ireland. People have grown up here in the UK, France, Germany, everywhere, right? So people are kind of like, the TV stuff you've written is really good, Brian. It's spot on. Linear TV advertising is definitely on the decline, right? But it's not dying at the rate that people think it's dying.
Yeah, like, and Europe is very different. I totally agree. I mean, in the sense that I think that the preference away from ad-supported television will be universal, especially as more better content is available in on-demand environments through streaming services. Although one thing that has caused me to, two things have happened in the last year that have caused me to modify how I'm thinking about things. The first is that I didn't think that as many of the US-based streamers would kind of give up on Europe as quickly as they did. Like, there was so much investment in original programming from the Maxes, the Paramounts, etc. And they've really scaled that back in a way that I didn't quite anticipate. If you're Netflix, you're Amazon, you're Apple, oh my God, this is a great opportunity, right? But I think it slows that pace, but because Amazon, Netflix, and Apple are not going to give up, I don't think it changes the trajectory. Yeah,
but they're I think John will attest this. We have some brilliant conversations in the office here, like about our head of operations, Lindsay, our COO, who talks about how people watch Ant and Dec, right? Like, these are like, there's celebrities on TV. Like, they're like two young fellas that kind of, they're not young anymore, but they're kind of like national treasures where they host this stupid like TV program on Saturday night. But it gets millions and millions and millions of people watching it, right? So, like, John will attest to this. They can't underestimate like localized content production. So, well, I totally agree that Disney has massive like IP. Netflix is just
to be clear, they were making multi-hundred million dollar bets in Spain, multi-hundred million dollar bets in Germany, of German language content, of Spanish language content. They were all doing that. And now, well, it's going to be Netflix, who's again putting a couple hundred million euros a year into Italy, several hundred million euros a year into Germany for German language programming, Amazon more than that, right? They're going to, here's a theory I have, and you can tell me I'm wrong, but my theory is that there is a direct relationship between share of viewing and share of investment in programming. So in other words, if the UK or pick a market has £1 billion or €1 billion of spending by studios collectively on content for air on home-based video screens, if you account for 20% of that spending, roughly, my guess is you'll get 20% of viewing over time. And there's a reason behind this, because my view is that the price of content ultimately conforms to the end value. And, you know, if you get a high profile person who can attract a large audience over time, you're not going to overpay for this content. So if you make that argument, take Germany, for example, where I think that it's a little cleaner because you don't have to worry about this cross-border analysis of, you know, people in the US will watch English language content from the UK and vice versa. If you take Germany, and I forget the specific numbers, but if RTL and ProSiebenSat.1 each spend about €1 billion a year on programming in total. If Amazon spends €400 million a year on German language programming, and Netflix spends €200 million a year, if let's just say that was the, and say there's a couple of others, so you get to €3 billion of programming in German every year. 20% of that is coming from Netflix and Amazon. If that keeps up, I would bet 20% of viewing will be on Amazon and Netflix.
You think that's it?
Unless the content was shit.
Well, yeah, but over time, I believe in the spaghetti against the wall theory of content. If you do, like, eventually you'll hire the right people and eventually you'll randomly create a hit. You don't know which one will be a hit. Nobody knows nothing about, right, as the line, the saying goes. But eventually you'll find hits. Eventually you'll find content that meet the moment. And over time, if those ratios hold up of spending, you would have 20% of viewing.
Possibly.
Okay. So if you believe in that, again, Netflix and Amazon are not giving up. I believe that in on-demand environments, people do not willfully, preferably choose ad-supported tiers. There has to be, the price gap has to be substantially different.
I totally, John, you can tell them about our theory about ad-funded tiers or paid-for ad-funded tiers.
Yeah, it's a conversation we have quite a lot. And the feeling generally is that the market in the UK is different to the US and that people here just won't pay for ads. Like, having an ad-supported tier that is still paid for is a mistake for streamers in the UK market because people are used to their ad-supported TV being free. And the ad tiers won't be as beneficial to the streamers in the UK as perhaps they would be in the US, which is a bit more of a ripe market for it.
I don't think they're going to be that robust here either. I mean, the point is that, I think that, again, the whole nature of so much television viewing is passive or tertiary. Like, it's on television historically, so much programming, again, what I've seen from German programming, a lot of British programming. Oh, and certainly if you think of in an American context, the legacy Discovery Networks, a lot of reality-based programming, historically it was just passive, it was ambient, it was like radio but video, right? And when you transitioned, there's amazing research that a group called Committee for Research Excellence did, Nielsen funded but administered independently in the late 2000s, did when it was the biggest ethnographic study of TV consumption I'm aware of that's ever been conducted. Millions of dollars went into this research. And it was trying to understand how people really consume television. And it looked at multitasking. Now, it's well worth reading the study. I think there's a lot of valid ideas in it today, even if it's kind of a generation ago, essentially. But one of the ideas that I formed, and I believe to be true, but it's hard to prove, is that in a world where everything is on demand, where if you have access primarily to on-demand programming that's really good and compelling, as basically most content streaming services is, or there's so much of it that's so good. There's no room in your habit, in your media consumption diet, for that ambient content. The kind of content that, again, Discovery Scripts kind of popularized, right? If your viewing then is intentional in this world, your tolerance for advertising is non-existent, or it's very, very low. You'll tolerate ads because you're not flipping the TV. It's just on. Ads can be around. They might be impactful subconsciously, right? But it's also probably the case you're not actively paying attention. Now, the bright side in this world is that where there is any advertising or commercial messaging, like even in an ad-free tier, this program is brought to you by your favorite soap. You're probably going to remember it. So that's a good thing for marketers, right? There is opportunity in this world. But the sheer tonnage of ad impressions that were delivered in the old world, and again, I'd include most of European broadcasting as I've seen it as part of this, I think that the viewing will over time shift away. Again, back to this theory about share spend on programming, we'll take share of viewing over time. And that means less ad consumption, less reach potential, et cetera, et cetera.
Can I ask a question? The two of you, by the way. I'll answer the same question after you. When was the last time you seen an ad on TV? John, start with you first.
Interestingly, it was watching Channel 4 a couple of weeks ago. I was watching something on 4OD and was served the same advert four times in a row, which I then spoke to a CTV company that we know. So why has this happened? Why was I served the same nappy commercial four times in a row in the same ad break? So that was the last time. And that's the last ad I saw, I think.
Ryan?
Probably yesterday. I get ads every day because I have Bloomberg.
But I don't count them. Like the Bloomberg ads are more like promotional ads. I don't count them.
No. Not on your connected TV. Yes, I also get the same ad four times, but worse, because it'll be like Febreze in Spanish.
Yeah.
you're getting those terrible ads. Do you know what? I don't know if I'm an isolated entity, but I have no exposure to TV ads at the minute. I'm not seeing any ads. The last ad I seen was, I have Now TV, which is basically Sky's bundled on streaming channel, basically. And they have live sports, and I will tolerate ads in live sports. Weirdly, I've been programmed to tolerate because it's kind of part of, I don't know, I almost accept it as part of the sort of whole process. Like the ads are, in my mind, okay around live sports because
in sports because, again, that's the flow of the programming. That ambient kind of content where it was on the background. You didn't really think much of it because, frankly, you didn't think much of the programming. In sports, there's these natural breaks. As long as the breaks are natural or semi-natural, then you can stuff an ad in, no problem.
Interesting.
But that's the problem because the nature of how programming is being developed and made today, it's being made to be consumed in an on-demand world. It's being made, it's much more immersive than it used to be. And so it's hard to go back on that.
Interesting.
I think, it does go back to Kieran's point a little bit about, you know, we hear a lot in our industry, in our bubble, about the death of linear TV and how no one's watching anymore. But still, you can have a program with the greatest budget, highest production values, and they're not going to beat Ant and Dec in the UK on a Saturday night. People are still going to watch that on ITV at 8 p.m. on a Saturday.
Because it's event TV. It's event TV.
But my bet is over time, I think that the percentage of – there's two ways to look at it. One is the percentage of viewing that's ad-supported and the percentage of impressions that are ad-supported in any given country will fall. Again, I think that trajectory is different in Europe. Let's rule out, I guess, Belgium and the Netherlands, because they always had high cable penetration. But in markets where you never had that kind of a cable-based environment, over time, it'll just be a slower trajectory down, assuming Netflix, Amazon, and Apple continue to invest in original programming and continue to have primarily ad-free subscribers. As long as that's true, what I said will be true. It'll just be slower in Europe. Again, actually, in Viaplay going down, that was a big deal, back to my thesis, right? Because I was really surprised how they just kind of gave up, like completely gave up. they were the only non-American who is trying at all. And it befuddled me that they didn't seem, I mean, did they really go into this thinking that this was going to be like massively money-making? I mean, Disney seemed to think so incorrectly too. And that was like obviously incorrect from the get-go. But nonetheless, it won't be that. That's also that'll also slow this trend, if you will, right? I think that, but over time, I think that this is inevitable. So the decline of ad-supported television in terms of ad spending, ad revenue, consumption, I don't think it's going to be positive in Europe, but it probably won't be as negative as it will be in the US.
Do you think so? Do you think that ad-supported TV is going to decline because of just
absolutely
the point that you just made? So where does that money go, Brian? That's like, Jesus Christ, we're gonna get to a 2-hour podcast here, like, because like there's so many rabbit holes. Like, I think about this as well, right? If I'm not seeing ads, should marketers be spending more money in out of home to get my attention on billboards, or should they be spending, like, does that money shift elsewhere?
It is shifting. I mean, this is the thing. You're seeing right now, certainly packaged goods companies, 201 are increasing their budgets high single digits year over year, but their spending on TV is falling. Now, retail media, again, primary beneficiary. Amazon, huge beneficiary. TikTok, huge beneficiary. Let's separate what they should do from what they will do. What they will do is shift money for like brands, for like media goals. Generally speaking, digital platforms are capturing those budgets. But here's the bigger trend that's going on. And I've argued this in various ways over the last 10 or 15 years. It's the most important driver of advertising is creative destruction. Not the end of J. Walter Thompson. No, I mean the idea that businesses replace other businesses over time. The economy evolves over time. No laughs for the J. Walter Thompson thing. Come on.
Sorry. we're obviously just
no, but the idea of creative destruction is important in economics, and it's important in advertising. That what we end up seeing is businesses that organize themselves around what the economy can do and what media owners and media channels can do. And so you already see this to some degree, certainly in China, from what I understand from my former colleagues told me what was happening there, and you probably will see it here. If businesses basically start to say, well, wait, we can organize our business around the premise that our retail partners are primary marketing channels. Let's alter what our business looks like to capitalize on that, right? Let's make sure we're subscription oriented. The product feature of the business has subscription elements. Think of coffee, right? I mean, Nespresso as a product is an evolved product that capitalizes on the way that the media world works, right? And so if you think about it through that lens over time, the manufacturers who capitalize on what television could do uniquely, build brands, it's just less common as a feature of businesses going forward. We're already seeing that, as I said, in China. My former colleagues there would lament how nobody's building brands anymore. Everyone's focusing on performance.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, the focus on performance, as we discussed earlier, people are more cautious and performance is becoming a real kind of a key factor for marketers making decisions.
But to be clear, it's not to say that television can't produce performance. It just requires more assumptions. It's harder to persuade marketers that you can get as much performance, even though I think we all know objectively that a bigger brand will drive better performance, however you want to define it. And you can probably build a bigger brand with television, blah, blah, blah. But just because there's a good decision doesn't mean it's the one that will be taken.
Yeah. Kieran, what do you think?
It feels like I'd love to kind of feed this back to the CTV crowd who see this as a sort of like the dawning of a new age for ad tech. But like I started to think about there's definitely going to be lower ad loads in that space because people are watching streaming and their habits have completely changed in terms of how to consume media. You could argue that like the TV stuff is interesting because it's still one of the biggest sort of media channels in the world, right, still represents probably about 160 to 200 billion or to spend the war, right? It's as big as, you know, it's a huge channel. So, you know, if marketers are changing their way of sort of like trying to reach customers, that money needs to go somewhere else. And it's interesting that we've mentioned retail media, but I'd also like to see, you know, what effect does that have on ad tech, Brian? Because you seem very, like, I've read your newsletters. I read them religiously, man. I'd like, you know, listeners are should think about signing up to Brian's, or should sign up, not should think about it. Just forget about thinking. Just do it.
Because it's free right now, madisonwall.substack.
There you go. It's free right now. And that's the run of term. talk about that again. But like, what effect does this have in ad tech? I mean, I guess it doesn't really, because ad tech just evolves. You know, the one thing about ad tech is it evolves with the environment around it, right? So it could be TV, it could be out of home. It kind of evolves to building the framework for the next sort of media consumption piece.
Ad tech, I mean, here's the thing. And I do, I you know, I did spend a year working in ad tech. So I'll claim to have thought about this a little bit from a firsthand perspective. In addition to covering some of the stocks in the space, but ad tech is, in my mind, nothing more than the operations of the industry.
Yeah.
And let's not overcomplicate what that is. And specialized sort of service providers and software companies that enable the operations of the business. That's it.
It's the infrastructure. It's the infrastructure for advertising and marketing. That's the way it should be seen.
There's always a need for that. Now,
yeah.
Does that mean that there are some businesses that are bigger than others, some that are higher margin than others? I mean, sure. I think that I don't know that ad tech should think of it as itself as something special necessarily in that context. I mean, not different than any other infrastructure related industry, and that's great. I mean, there are good businesses inside of ad tech. So, what does it mean? I mean, frankly, from what I've seen, it just means anyone who's trying to be in this space, who's specializing in this space, just needs to think about, well, where are the biggest opportunities to drive out cost, improve efficiency, and add value with operations? That's it. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, I know, but that's how I think about it, at least.
Yeah. Have anything to add on that one, Kieran?
Well, I invest in ad tech, so I would be an eternal optimist about it, and I totally agree about the
one can, like, be optimistic. I mean, if you believe that the degree to which infrastructure can provide value to the sector outweighs than any other part of the industry can produce value, then that's great. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that, and I'd argue Martech.
Absolutely, and look. Retail media, right, is a whole new area of the sort of media marketing landscape, right? And it's going to need infrastructure, right? It's going to need measurement. Totally. It's going to need targeting. It's going to need ad serving. It's going to need all the rest. So all that stuff. And likewise, you look at gaming, right? Because, you know, it's an attention-based war, right? So the people who are not watching TV are also, you know, might be playing games, right? So that's ad-funded. Again, you need the same infrastructure. You need the same sort of targeting and measurement. So I don't see any problems at all. Like, it's like, you know, I think ad tech's pretty safe. It's interesting that, you know, Brian's newsletter is around TV. I wonder, you know, if you look at ad tech, then you look at the agencies, because obviously you've done a lot of work with the agencies. I mean, are they similarly affected by this shift in this shift in sort of brand behavior in terms of spending, you know, marketing dollars, euros, and pounds?
They're definitely impacted. But I mean, the challenge for them is whether or not they continue to invest in the right people in the right places doing the right things. I mean, it's that also is an oversimplification. But I mean, actually, as you were talking about it, I was thinking of, you know, if you know Profitero, if I pronounce that correctly, right? Good example, Publicis buying Brian Wiener.
Profitero, the are they like a ads based sort of for marketplace, Amazon and all the rest of it?
Well, but they're connecting, I mean, marketer supply chains through to the retail media, right? I mean, the point is that, you know, as long as you see agencies investing in services that help marketers one way or another, whether now, is that pure ad tech as we've known it? I mean, it's not purely like what, as I understand, Citrus Ad does or what Criteo is trying to do. It's very different, I think, in the sense of trying to help manufacturers more broadly, ultimately, with their marketing goals. The point I'm trying to make is that when you look at agencies, as long as they continue to make investments in places where marketers need services and things that they can't or won't do themselves, then agencies are great. Agencies can continue to evolve and adapt. The risk is that they, and I, you know, I don't know if you saw this piece I wrote earlier this year. I've had to revise some of my own thinking, you know, even as an analyst, and I'll say a pretty good one in the 2010s. I completely,
you're still the GOAT. Ryan, come on.
Well, thank you. I completely missed this. And I know that CEOs of the major holding companies missed this too. Every one of us who said agencies were growing slowly in the late 2010s were wrong. Full stop, wrong. What I realized having done some more fresh analysis of that era is that the biggest holding companies did not grow for a number of reasons that I think are widely known, right? And zero-based budgeting. Sure, there's some issues around transparency that were minor, a little bit of insourcing, a lot of other little issues, some IT services competition, et cetera. And we all believe that that was what was happening. And the optimists were thinking, ah, it's just transitory. It's just temporary. And of course, we did see some great growth more recently, and that kind of validated that view, right? But now my new thinking, having analyzed the mid-sized guys and a lot of private companies in my current capacity, and then just looking at the world with fresh eyes, I've realized, oh my God, the industry actually continued to grow at a mid-single digit level. It's just that the holding companies lost share. As concurrently, their returns on equity went way up and their invested capital went way down because they were focusing on share buybacks. They're focusing on paying out dividends. They're failing to invest in the business in 2015, 16, 17, and 18. Phil Publicis bought Epsilon, Interpublic bought Acxiom, and obviously WPP disinvested in a lot of things, right, in the immediate post-Martin era. But the point is that you didn't see this massive reinvestment in the business until late 2018 and 2019. And shocker, the industry grows when there's investment against it. And this was a really important point, and it's helped reframe some of my thinking, that as long as agencies continue to keep capital in the business, if not plowing more capital into the business, they will continue to grow. They may, on the other hand, for fashion, reasons of fashion and preferences among investors that they choose to cultivate, they may choose to prioritize shorter-term capital efficiency. And guess what will happen if they do that again? You won't see any growth.
Interesting.
Really interesting. Brian, that's all we've got time for, I think, for this one. We are definitely going to have you
do
back.
Do a series.
Yeah,
we're going to have to talk with Brian.
We'll bring you back for a part two, if you would like. But no, thank you so much for your time today. That was a really interesting discussion and great to get you two together. So thank you so much.
This was fun. Thanks for having me.
Great. And Kieran, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Like a whirlwind through ad tech and the media world with Brian here. It's great stuff.
We'll definitely do it again. Great. Well, that was the Mad Tech Podcast special, and thank you all for listening. Cheers.